is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with a rabbit. We're going to be discussing Hillary Clinton's recent speech and how her speech led to a lot of new traffic for Rabbit's site, altleft.com. Rabbit, it's great having you back on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back, finally.
So Hillary Clinton gave this speech about the alt-right and the alt-right support for Donald Trump. Before the speech happened, there was all this anticipation because people said it was going to give the alternative right all this new publicity. And every major newspaper in the country basically had like a front page article about this speech with the word alt-right on it. And I guess to start things off, Rabbit, can you talk about your take on her speech?
Yeah, well, I think the most interesting thing to me was that that she mentioned the alt-right by name, because when it leading up to the speech, I thought, and I think a lot of people did, that she was just going to kind of vaguely try to tie Trump to these extremists or something. But she actually named the alt-right by name, which I thought was very surprising, and I think it just led tons of people to be able to look into the alt-right specifically and find all of this stuff on the internet.
When you name something explicitly, you give them a sense of legitimacy as opposed to just saying, oh yeah, there's a bunch of dangerous kooks out there.
Yeah, well, but you're also directing them specifically to something that they can go to look at, whereas otherwise people would be like, well, who is she really talking about? Like, I don't get, like, but they can go in there, and she's actually directing them to it by mentioning by name.
Then they'll read all these websites like Alternative Right and a Red External and a Countercurrents.
They'll start talking about. I noticed that like Glenn Beck and some of these other conservatives were like, they're actually talking about Richard Spencer on there, and of course these people are all horrified because they like, they've never even heard of people like Steve Saylor and whatnot, but they're like suddenly like finding out about this stuff. They've been living in this this bubble the last 5 or 6 years, you know, without any knowledge of this stuff, totally living in their own like cheesy like mainstream conservative happy meal conservatism world.
The alt-right was a pretty small marginal movement until the Trump campaign happened. I mean, I've been following it since the beginning, but that's when it really got like a widespread support. I see a lot of similarities between the alt-right and the Trump campaign and Ron Paul's movement in 2008 of libertarianism. But I think even on a much larger scale, I mean, obviously Donald Trump is a much more significant candidate than Ron Paul, but you could also make the point that the alt-right has the same energy, if not an influence, and the same energy and impact, if not more so, that the libertarian movement had back then.
Yeah, I think so, because it's something that that is newer, and that it's also something that's a little bit more shocking to, I guess, probably just normal journalists and pundits and stuff, because they kind of live in this bubble, you know, like the current year, like, oh, it's 2016. Like, you know, why do they're not expecting any kind of mass movement from any kind of a racial identity movement or anything like that emerging. Like, they totally thought that stuff is non-existent anymore, except for these old people who are just about to die off, and then suddenly they discover that there's thousands of these blogs and whatnot that are run by like millennials and Generation X people that are really just kind of up and coming, and I think it's got to be something that's somewhat it's shocking to them, and I think that makes it much larger than libertarianism, which was always kind of in the background.
It's basically a youth movement, and the meme has always been that there's all these like old guys who are going to die off soon.
Yeah, in fact, that's like when I used to be like debating people or something. You know, they would always say that thing with like, you know, oh, when your generation dies off, like, you know, we're, all this stuff is going to go away and we're going to take over. But if you look at these, like, the people involved in these movements are, you know, most of them, like, are in their early, like, you know, early 20s or late teens. Like, I've noticed that even younger, especially in these 8chan groups or whatnot, some of these people are, like, 15, 16, that are getting into this stuff. You know, so it's not... it's an illusion, you know, that it's these old people. Actually, like, a lot of the old people are more, the old people Trump supporters, I think, are just more like the kind of old school, like, Tea Party, types who maybe want to restrict immigration a little bit, but the real radical people are the young people, from what I've seen.
So what happened with the Hillary Clinton speech is Donald Trump responded, Trump basically said there isn't an alt-right or an alt-left, they're just like a common sense. And I basically agree with what Trump was saying, because a lot of these labels get people like pigeonholed and they put you in a box, and it's better just to like tell basically just like the basic truth. But what happened is then people heard about the alt-right and they said, huh, there's an alt-left, I wonder what that is. And then all these journalists started Googling the alt-left and like speculating about it, because no one's really heard about that until now, and that's getting you a massive traffic.
Yeah, I mean, I received like a ton of traffic in the last day or so, and it's like it keeps increasing, because as like people find it, then they're like posting about it and linking my site. And whatnot. And one thing that I found is kind of amusing is that a lot of like these conservative, like these conservative types and you know, mainstream conservative are actually promoting my site for me, and like they're like trying to tie it to Hillary, you know, because she tried to tie the alt-right to Trump. They're trying to tie like these you know, those racialist ideas in the alt-left, she's trying to tie that, they're trying to tie that to Hillary, you know, which, so I have this one, there's like people have been doing this on Twitter, and I noticed there's one guy who's just obsessed, you know, some kind of like conservative writer, and he must have tweeted the link out to my site like 20 or 30 times to all of these different pundits.
You should get like a screenshot of that and put it on your website.
I will do it. I took some screenshots of it, and I posted it on Twitter because I thought it was amusing, but I should post it on my site, because you know, he's like tweeting at all of these conservative pundits like Etsy Cup, you know, just these you know, these idiots or whatever. Then he's just like, why aren't you talking about the alt left, you know, Hillary?
I never thought you would,
something like that.
You would be on the dole of the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, well, it makes you wonder, like, you know, how stupid people could possibly be, that they, you know, they have absolutely no reading comprehension, these adults. It's actually kind of scary to me, like, just how dumb some of these people are. Like,
well, people don't actually do research. They don't bother to look up what the alt-left is. If you actually bothered to do research, you would Google alt-left, you would come across your website, some of the podcasts that we've done in the show, and also, like, some articles that Lindsay has written.
Yeah, you know, you could find, like, my site or Robert Lindsay's sites, or even, you know, some of these other groups that are out there, like the National Bolsheviks. You know, there is a 4chan group that related to that that's pretty popular, and some of these other, you know, National Bolshevik forums, and there's various other kind of elements in the alternative left, and I really kind of find it obnoxious, because they, you know, they don't bother to even Google something before they you imagine writing an article for like a national publication, a mainstream publication, writing about that and not even bother to like Google the terms or do any kind of research beforehand. They just go in and start like, oh, I'm going to start like pontificating about this with just absolutely no idea of like where these terms originate or if they're being used. And you know, I used this example before, you know, as someone who's like an artist or a writer or a musician or any of that, like, you know, when you come up with a title or something for like a project or a song or something, like, I always like Google it to see like if it's been used before or like what else it's associated with. If it's like, like coming up with a title for a movie that you're making or something, but it turns out it's already a movie that's like won awards or something like that. Like, these people don't even bother to do the tiniest bit of research. It's not even like the stuff is hard to find. All you'd have to do is Google something, and it's on the first page you Google. You could probably find 5 or 6 articles for now. Pretty soon, like, this, our sites and everything will all be buried because there'll be all of these news articles, like on BuzzFeed and whatnot, just completely misinforming people about these things. But kind of like if you search for the alt-right now, you know, you're not, the first hit isn't going to be like Countercurrents or Radix or the right stuff. It's going to be,
well, the alternative right website does show up in a Google search.
Well, it might, but I searched for alt-right just a little while ago, and you know, all of the stuff that comes up on the first page is mostly it's mostly just articles that are just completely misinformed about the alt-right. Like, they're not directing people to the right stuff, you know, no pun intended.
So with the alt-left, it was something that was a project of Robert Lindsay, and basically what the alt-left is, it's people who are generally on the left. They're people who hold economically leftist views and who tend to be either centrist to left on social issues, but they reject all the crazy like SJW type stuff and extreme political correctness, and they're not crazy about mass immigration. That's basically, to summarize it up, that's basically what alt-left is.
Yeah, and just varying degrees of race realism and kind of rejecting a lot of the blank slate ideology and really an embrace of like, you know, human biodiversity and there are kind of like different factions and degrees of race realism on the alt left.
Your views are different than Robert Lindsay's on some issues.
Well, a little bit, sure, but they're mostly differing on terms of like proposing solutions to these problems. I think if you read his blog, you see that he really has a lot of the same views. He just has like different ideas about what to do about the future. And these are all like differences that only people like us are going to appreciate. You know, if you're like a normal, like a journalist or like a, just really like a kind of a basic bitch, lefty or something like that, or Republican, you know, any embrace of like the idea that, you know, races could be different, or that diversity is like can be a bad thing or anything like that, like they're immediately all going to be lumped in as like being neo-Nazis or something like that. Like, they're not going to appreciate.
And even in the case of Robert Lindsay goes actually out of his way to like, he even says this is officially an anti-racist blog, and he still gets attacked like mercilessly by SJWs all the time.
Yeah, totally. In fact, when I was talking to somebody, I was like, well, you know, Robert Lindsay has similar views to mine, but you know, I'm probably he's probably more, I would say, like, he's more identified with a lot of the anti-feminist stuff and more like manosphere stuff. Like, he kind of identifies with a lot of those ideas, whereas like I don't like most of that stuff, but at the same time I'm probably more racial than he is. But when I showed somebody else the blog, they're like, they thought like that he was he's way more racist than you, like, what are you talking about? And like I wouldn't have picked up on that, because we pick up on these nuances, but just from the tone of some of his articles and some of his ideas, they concluded that, like, you know, they didn't pick up on these nuanced differences.
People usually don't pick nuances. They just like to label people and put them in boxes.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, that's kind of, you know, one of the reasons that I kind of signal on racial issues is because it's like once, you know, there's really no point in being like, oh, I'm anti-racist or something. Like, if you believe in any kind of like racial IQ differences or that different, you know, or that culture can be informed by biology at all.
They're also saying that Bernie Sanders and Jill Stein are the alt-left.
Yeah, and I pointed that out on my blog. Like, that's just really ridiculous because they, you know, the alt-left was about, like, rejecting a lot of the stuff that they stand for. Like, you know, Bernie and Jill Stein represent the dominant ethos in the modern or postmodern left, which is they're social justice, like, warrior candidates. You know, they support, like, Black Lives Matter and all of this weird, like, this freaky, like, Tumblr feminism and, you know, gender fluid and all that kind of, you know, fat acceptance and all that weird stuff. And they're really the dominant ethos in schools in terms of what kids are taught in grade school, throughout high school and college, and all throughout the media promotes this stuff. You know, if you watch the Super Bowl or any kind of sports ball, you've got Beyonce in there, like, doing, like, a Black Panther routine and stuff like that. Like, they're totally on board with all of this stuff. There's nothing alternative about them. They just might be a little bit more socialist on some of these economic issues than Hillary, but Hillary is not really much of a leftist anyway. She's mostly just kind of like a neoconservative, neoliberal, like politician, really.
I know Bernie Sanders did make that comment early on in the campaign where he said that the open borders was a Koch brothers or right wing conspiracy.
Yeah, he did, but he's since, like, embraced open borders for the most part. And, you know, with him and Jill Stein, you know, they want to, you know, flood the country with these refugees and bring in Muslims. You know, they support Black Lives Matter. And, you know, I think, you know, Bernie, you famously had those Black activists, like, come and protest him and get on stage, and, like, he didn't even, like, do anything, and then he totally caved in to all of their demands or anything. So whatever kind of, you know, kind of meek resistance he had to open borders, it was totally empty, and right away he endorsed Hillary. So, you know, what is there really that you have to work with is that he seems to embrace a lot of far left ideology, but not at all willing to create the kind of environment where those things could be successful at all.
And then there was this article by the Conservative Review by the writer Daniel Horowitz, and this is about the Hillary speech, and he describes Hillary Clinton, the pioneer of the alt-left. I don't know, is this the guy who was trolling you on Twitter, this Daniel Horowitz?
No, it wasn't him. It was just some random. It's actually, there are quite a few people that have been doing that and posting the links, totally confused.
Anyhow, but he's been saying that Hillary Clinton is the alt-left, and he starts this article out. He says that the conservative movement is made up of the different factions, including the Tea Party, the Chambercrats, the Libertarians, the Constitutional Conservatives, neoconservatives, paleoconservatives, and everything in between. And that basically that traditional conservatism has been based on, like, on the values of, like, the Constitution, liberty, patriotism, and the Judeo-Christian founding of this nation. And he goes on to say that the alt-right, they want to replace that with, like, a European nationalist populism, kind of similar to, like, say, Marine Le Pen.
Yeah, well, I mean, setting aside the fact that, you know, that he wrote the article without even bothering to Google the alt-left or even, you know, research it the teeniest bit, you find that those kind of conservatives are really like, they buy into this mythology about the U.S. being these, you know, these abstract ideals and values and whatnot, where, you know, that's kind of more of a newer classification of it. It's a newer idea because even though the founders expressed a lot of that stuff, they restricted citizenship to, you know, to whites only. You know, they weren't these like
not only that, I mean, the founding fathers didn't even want Catholics here.
Right, and if you look at the nation's like first immigration law, which is the Naturalization Act of 1790, it's very clear. It says specifically that, you know, it restricts citizenship to whites only. And, you know, whether you agree with that or not, this mythology that the, you know,
I mean, obviously liberals would be opposed to that, but in some ways liberals are a lot more honest about the founding of the nation and the founding fathers than these conservatives are.
Yeah, because the ones who oppose that are always, you know, they're the ones that point out that, like, you know, that the founders were, you know, quote, like, racist or, you know, and that the Civil War wasn't about slavery. It was about preserving the Union and that, like, you know, Lincoln wanted to deport.
There's a book called The People's History of the United States, and it's a leftist. It's a leftist book, and a lot of it is a kind of your stereotypical stuff you'd expect to find. But one thing that's interesting is he said Lincoln's motivation, this is by Howard Zinn, Lincoln's motivation wasn't to free the slave, but it was more about to consolidate, like, the economic power. He didn't want to lose all that economic capital from the South.
Well, right, there's that, but there's also the fact that he, you know, he's been kind of, you know, lionized as this kind of like a racial egalitarian or something, which, like, he wasn't, like, he, you know.
There's quotes from Lincoln that would be extremely racist by today's standard.
Yeah, and you know, when these, like, these conservative people or whatever, like, they're like, oh, you know, Trump is taking us away from the party of Lincoln. Can you believe the party of Lincoln is elected? When, like, you know, Trump hasn't said anything even close to the quotes that you could pull from Abraham Lincoln about, you know, wanting to, you know, he wanted to, like, repatriate blacks, you know, to like, Africa and the Caribbean and these other places. Like, he wasn't, it's not as if he wanted to have this totally egalitarian universalist society. So I think that a lot of these social justice types are you know, they're right. They're portraying the history somewhat accurately. I just don't, you know, they just view it as a bad thing. But these Republicans are just totally mixed up about, like, what the founders intended and what they actually believed. It's totally a mythology that they embrace.
Trump is basically like he's a civic nationalist. Is what his movement is all about, civic nationalism.
Yeah, that's what I think is kind of sad in a way, because when it gets right down to it, Trump really isn't racist or like a white nationalist or anything. I think he really does believe in the concept of, like, an Americanism, and where you come here and you kind of, like, you embrace the Western institutions and values, and then you're just like everybody else, and you can see that a lot of throughout his past and whatnot, that you know, he worked with a lot of these minorities and stuff, trying to help some of their communities and whatnot. You know, he worked with a lot of in boxing. You know, he had no problem working with a lot of these different figures in sports or whatever. He always had good relations with these people.
Mike Tyson supports Donald Trump.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, it's just that you get called a racist just because he wants to. We've come to a point where just the idea of like wanting to restrict immigration just a teeny tiny bit, like, he's not even really extreme on that position. Like, if
he sounds pretty moderate. He's saying, like, you might have a person who's they originally came here illegally, but they've been here 20 years and they haven't broken the law, and maybe we should consider them letting them stay here. So in a lot of ways, his proposals are not that harsh at all.
They're not at all. It's just where we've come in the current year that suddenly those things have become controversial, just to restrict immigration. I mean, even just the idea that we shouldn't take in like hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees or something, somehow that is like just that horrifies people, that we can keep people out like at all. The concept of even having a nation state with defined borders has just become totally taboo.
What that article from the Conservative Review, his point is that that the alternative left, he's trying to say that they're the radical left of like Hillary's support, and he like groups like Black Lives Matter and Marxists. But he goes on to say actually Hillary's existing Democratic Party is a mirror image of what the political right in America would be like if all its prominent figures and elected officials had accounts at Stormfront.org, the neo-Nazi internet forum.
Yeah, so he's totally confused about the alternative left. What he's talking about in terms of the left is more of the dominant left, which actually is.
Ironic is the same writer is using the term cultural Marxism, which is a popular alt-right buzzword.
Yeah, that's true, and he doesn't understand the fact that the alt-right is.
He also goes on to say that the alt-left engages in anti-Semitism.
But his concept of anti-Semitism is Horowitz sees Jews is just the fact that they're not pro-Israel. Remember that qualifies as anti-Semitism. In neoconservative circles, not being pro-Israel means you're an anti-Semite, even if you just think it's none of our damn business or something to be over there. So the leftists he's talking about are like these Palestinian activists and whatnot. He's not talking about the actual alternative left where people recognize that that Jews have a tendency to promote mass immigration and multiculturalism and kind of open borders and just the influence in the media and so forth. Like, he's not talking about that stuff. Remember, in these circles, that anti-Semitism, from his standpoint, just means not willing to fight in Israel's wars or be supportive of them.
So, with all these labels, I think as we've been talking about, these labels put people in boxes, and they're very divisive, and they allow your enemies to kind of control you by putting a label on you. So you're actually thinking, even though your blog is getting all this traffic now, you're thinking of changing the name and having it more be sort of a apolitical, sort of literary cultural magazine, rather than just politically oriented without a political name, and just kind of throwing out the sort of the labels, like the whole left-right paradigm. And I think we've talked about this a lot on previous shows. I think culture is a lot more effective way of getting your message across. You see all these conservative sites like a Red State and National Review, and it's just like 100% politics. And even the alt-right is much better, but they devote most of their energy to politics as well.
I think that the terms left and right are no longer very applicable to politics the way they exist now, because it's more of a nationalist versus globalist, and also like all of this racial identity stuff and ethnopolitics and that kind of thing. It doesn't really fit as neatly into this left-right thing anymore. The problem I had is always that when I was kind of a fringe person on the alt-right, people would always kind of attack me and say, well, how can you call yourself right-wing if you you know, think that people should be allowed to marry robots, and you support all this weird, like, futurist transhumanist stuff and, like, you know, hedonism you know, this kind of, like, all of this kind of weird stuff.
Well, there's the alt-right, but then there's, like, third positionist and Strasserites. And they tend to be, like, a hardcore social conservatives and a cultural reactionaries. A lot of them are kind of subscribers, like, to Alexander Dugin. And they're kind of, they're very much, like, against American imperialism. They're third positionist. They're anti-capitalist. But they're also very, like, culturally traditionalist. Do you view those people as allies? Do you think there's too much friction?
Well, I that's something that always comes up, because whenever people, like, read into the alternative left ideas and whatnot, they're always like, you know, isn't this just like Strasserite, like third position? And it's like, well, if you've ever hung out with
the other group,
there's
the National Bolsheviks.
Right. Well, if you've ever hung out, like, in any of those circles, like, you know, people always say, like, oh, this is alternative left, like, isn't it that just, like, third position or Strasserite? But they're only looking at the economic component. If you spend any time around those people, like, they're very hardcore social conservative. They're always talking about, like, degeneracy, and they're very traditionalist, and they're almost more, like, I would say, like uptight about certain things as hardcore Christian, like, conservatives, like Westboro Baptist. You know, some of these third positionist types are more like that. So people are just ignoring the different
kind of ironic in history is, weren't the Strasserites, they weren't homosexual, but weren't they allies with, like, Ernst Röhm, who was homosexual, and he was persecuted for being a homosexual?
Oh, yeah, I mean, he was killed. I don't know that he was necessarily killed for that. It was kind of like, you know, he was seen as someone who could potentially cause problems for, you know, for Hitler. But I think that, yeah, it's kind of funny, but when you look in those circles, like, it's all the same kind of, it's still the same kind of real, like, bro culture and whatnot. So I consider those people to be...
Or one group is, like, a new resistance.
Yeah, I consider them to be, you know, like, allies. I'll pretty much ally with anyone who's, like, pro-white, but a lot of times, like, they don't necessarily want to ally with people like us, you know? But that's their choice, not mine.
But I don't think all these people are all monolithic. I think there's some people who are more flexible and open-minded, and then you have, like, the closed-minded people. I don't think they're all, like, I don't think these people are, like, a monolithic group.
Well, I don't think so either, but I think it's also tough to gauge, because a lot of times the persona that they present online, as far as the views, they don't necessarily live up to that in real life. So you could probably, maybe if you found out, like, what these people were like in their own lives or whatever, they wouldn't necessarily be as, like, as kind of uptight or prudish as they come across maybe on the internet or in their writings. You know, it's difficult to say. But I think
that's funny. There was this
cultural divide.
It's funny. There was this guy on Facebook, and he asked me if my paintings were, like, a critique of, like, modernity and, like, a modern day decadence. Like, if they were, like, a satire, and I said no. Like, I'm painting stuff that I feel that I'm passionate about, that I see as, like, a beautiful aesthetic, and he thought I was joking.
Yeah, well, that's another thing that, like, I dislike about a lot of these types, is that, you know, they're very kind of anti-modernist, and, you know, you and I both like a lot of, like, mid-century modern kind of architecture and, like, futurist architecture. Like, I like, you know, things like brutalism. And a lot of, like, old, like, Soviet, like, and East German architecture. And, like, these people are always, like, posting photos of that stuff, like, talking about how, you know, how could anyone like this? Like, look at how awful this is, you know, and so forth. And that's how I feel, is that, like, I like a lot of, like, you know, like minimalism, you know, paintings and like abstract expression, all the stuff that a lot of those people hate. So I think that there's really a great kind of cultural divide, and I think that there's, you know, on the alt-right, which...
I know Greg Johnson wrote an article about modern art, and he said something like, not all modern art is garbage. For instance, like Italian futurism is fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that like Jonathan Bowden wrote some stuff that was very...
He was an artist. He was a painter himself. He painted like abstract art.
Yeah, he did, and he wrote some stuff that was kind of more more pro modern art in some regards, and at least more like ambiguous towards a lot of it. But I think that, you know, among people like Richard Spencer and Greg Johnson, I think those people are more receptive culturally to some of this stuff. But the rank and file of the alt-right seems to be very heavily dominated by like this bro culture. You know, so I think that there's kind of a cultural divide. You know, so when I was like part of the alt-right, that was one thing that always bugged me, was like that there was just this real bro culture about lifting and all of this stuff, and just kind of like just people into a lot of what I thought was a lot of like lame shit. You know, and so I have a lot of friends and stuff that are kind of like these underground artists and like that are like, you know, closet pro-white or, you know, ethno-nationalists or whatever, and they're always complaining like, yeah, like the worst thing about the alt-right is just these like these jock like bro dudes, and if this movement is really going to go anywhere, it's going to come.
So one of the reasons
from, like,
I think a lot of people become liberals is you get these guys who are kind of a little bit nerdy and intellectual, and they associate like right wingers with like the jocks who bully them in high school.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, not just like jocks who bully them or whatever, but just people who are just like into like into lame stuff. You know, like other people are more like kind of culturally kind of snobbish. You know what I mean? Like these people, like you can't talk to them about like Italian films or something from the 1950s.
You could talk to like a Richard Spencer or Greg Johnson about this stuff. It's like the rank and file. There's a divide.
And that's part of the problem, I think, with the whole left-right paradigm, is because the people that they're having to appeal to are having, because it's quote the right, it's just these preconceived notions about almost everything about the world, you know. So when you're bringing in these like you know, traditionalist like hardcore Christians and stuff from the South, like, or you're bringing in these Tea Party Republicans, like, they don't just like abandon everything, like they bring with them a lot of baggage, you know, that becomes incorporated into the whole package.
And that's what's happening with the alt-right becoming widespread, is that you have mainstream sites like Breitbart promoting it now. And on one hand, I think it's fantastic that it's growing so rapidly. But the downside is that it's getting flooded with all these mainstream conservatives, and they're bringing in all their baggage.
Right. And people always say that, like, oh, you know, well, we need to make this like a big tent movement or something. And I agree, but when you make the movement big tent, like, the people that come in have to at least be informed about, like, what the few, like, core principles are, you know, and of the alt-right.
We're not, like, the alt-right. We're kind of, like, outliners out there doing our own thing.
Right, but, I mean, you know, the same thing can be said really of any movement. So you have these people are like, oh, these Breitbart people are allies or whatever. We should just embrace this big tent. It's like, yeah, you should embrace the big tent, but these people have to, at least when they come into the big tent completely misinformed about like what the movement is about, then there really is no big tent. The growth that you're getting is empty, because if people come into the movement not realizing that it's about white identity and the race realism and all these core principles, like regardless, you know, what varying degrees you may feel about them, if they're totally misinformed about it, and they come in thinking like, yeah, you know, Democrats are the real racists, you know, and we're just anti-PC, you know, the growth you're getting is completely empty. It's not real growth because they haven't even looked at your ideas. They don't even understand the basics of them.
You kind of conclude this article you're writing, like, is there a room for a chic left-wing futurist variety of soft fascism? And then you kind of conclude probably not, but you'd rather than dwell on unsolved ideological questions. What do you mean exactly by kind of a soft fascism? I know Robert Lindsay's alt-left. He describes himself as a hardcore anti-fascist.
Well, I think that, you know, first of all, the term, like, fascist, like, almost anyone who supports any kind of, like, racial solidarity or anything is going to be called a fascist. You know, so I think that, you know, what if you're going to have any kind of racial identity, then some kind of, like, you know, group-oriented movement or something that is which bring those on board. You keep in mind, like, the Soviet Union was often called, like, fascist too, by some people because of something to hold it together. You need some kind of, like, you need something that has a little bit of force. I say soft fascism because, like I said, the third positionist and that kind of stuff, you know, that's all, they're all real, like, hard asses, you know, like, they, like, Golden Dawn, I think they, like, you know, they beat up gays and things like that. They're real, like that. I think that you need some kind of,
are you talking,
you know,
about,
like,
someone,
like
a Marine Le Pen?
Yeah, so, well, someone like that, but, you know, I'm not completely familiar with all of the positions of National Front and all of that. They kind of, like, have changed over time, but I think that, you know, you need something to hold it together, but not, so when I say, like, a soft fascism, it's more of, like, a, you know, I always use the example of, like, kind of like a, you know, like a Logan's Run type society where you have, like, there's
well, in
a
Logan's
bit of
Run,
soft fascism there.
Both,
you know,
of us would be dead by now.
Well, I mean, of course, without the whole, like, you know, being killed at 30, ideally it would be, you know, more of like a transhumanist society. I always say that, you know, my, like personal, like political dream would be like some kind of like a island ethno state, like a, almost like a, you know, like a white or European commune that's futuristic, like a Logan's Run type civilization. There would be like an island with like a futuristic, like a, you know, 1970s, like Art Deco, you know, essentially like a gigantic like mall or resort type place that's like a living area for, you know, a few thousand people, and you have a little you know, military unit or whatnot, and it's very very futuristic, sort of commune that's technologically advanced and that is, you know, capable of defending itself. That's kind of what you know, my idea of a you know, kind of a idealistic civilization that I would kind of support. Now, I don't really, you know, I'm not really invested in the idea of,
I think
of the
interesting
of, like,
is,
America.
Like, we've interviewed these people about things like cities and urbanism, and like my ideal world, there would be like most of the United States would be like wilderness, but there'd be like these like small, like really compact futuristic cities. Or you'd have, it would be people who have like-minded values living in these like small kind of compact futuristic cities where everything is kind of vertical, and then you would have like a rapid transit by like monorails. So that's sort of how I, like, the ideal.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's kind of how I feel about it, too. And when I was involved with the, you know, neo-reaction community for a bit, that was kind of the stuff that really attracted it to me, was the idea of kind of exit politics, of setting up a city state somewhere which is like a very futuristic. And when I was part of it, like the group turned out to be mostly like these like traditional like Catholic monarchists, you know, and then some other like real like you know, people who wanted like Google to have its own city state and rule the world. And that's like not really what I had in mind, but that was the kind of thing that attracted me to it. I always go on these websites, and you can find that there's tons of these little like islands for sale, and they're really not even that expensive. And I always think that if enough people got together, like they could buy one of these and you know, and build some kind of massive like structure in there that people could live in or something, and create like a small city state on one of these islands. You know, that kind of stuff interests me.
I know it sort of also reminds me a little bit of Heinlein's ideology, like kind of a fusion of like left-wing views with like futurism and like a soft fascism. A lot of people view Heinlein that way.
yeah, exactly. And you know, something like Starship Troopers was kind of influential to me, because a lot of that stuff had was called fascist and whatnot, but it was kind of like we discussed, it was more of a soft fascism. It wasn't like this hyper traditionalist kind of thing like you know, like Mussolini and some of these other groups. It was more a little bit more like you know, hedonistic.
We did talk kind of about like retrofuturism, and we did that show about Las Vegas and like a different like hypothetical casino designs. And I think you mentioned like you like to say like a vaporwave casino, and then I sent you that picture.
Oh yeah, and what was that place called, like Neonopolis or something?
Yeah, Neonopolis.
But it's like, it's not really a casino. It's more like a mall in Vegas or something. I can't believe that we
like a low budget
right
mall.
There.
Yeah, we missed it. We were over there on Fremont Street. It's over there. It's like basically what it is like a low budget mall with like a food court with like fast food. It does that kind of aesthetic, reminds me of like the old like 80s food courts. But you were talking about a casino, but that's something done like kind of on a small scale, but it really does have that like vaporwave feel to it.
Yeah, and it seems like they did it without really, you know, it was made in 2002, so it was kind of before.
That's interesting. Yeah, it was 2002, but it just feels, it has such an 80s feel to it. Like, I was kind of expecting maybe it was built in, like, 1987. How does that look?
Yeah, well, it seems like they're, you know, they're missing, like, a branding or marketing opportunity. They should be capitalizing that and, you know, taking advantage of the fact that, of that. But, you know, I bet you if the people who go there, it's probably just considered like some, you know, some little ghetto place that no one would want to go to, which reminds me of a lot of stuff that, you know, that I like. It's kind of like when, you know, I like going to Circus because it has that Diamonds Are Forever. It's what will always like represent to me the scenes from Diamonds Are Forever in the 70s. But of course, like anyone who goes there, like it's not appreciated for that. It's just seen as like this real like kind of like shitty like worn down ghetto casino that should probably be torn down.
So with kind of your ideas of like these city states, could some of them be built on kind of like the Las Vegas casino model? Not necessarily like gambling per se, but where people sort of live in this one structure where you have like vertical living and people have access to like all their amenities within like walking distance. Like, I can really kind of see kind of the appeal to that. I've even seen these like futuristic renderings where in one like building you have like these like indoor like gardens, and everything is in with like a short like elevator ride or a walking distance. But most, this sort of this notion in America, like everyone has to like live in a single family home and like drive everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I don't dig that at all. I like the, you know, I guess the Las Vegas like casino model, but maybe not so much like that per se. I like more of the idea of these like these giant malls that could be essentially, you know, converted for into living areas where you combine like a mall atmosphere with like you know, food and like health clubs and all of these different kind of like, you know, nightlife activities within them.
So,
almost, you know, kind of like when I mentioned Logan's Run.
Logan's Run.
You take a city state. Yeah, you take that and you take like a giant kind of mall like that, and you put it somewhere, but it would just be very large, and it would be almost like a small, like, domed city with, like, an outdoor area maybe, too. But it would be mostly self-contained, and I think that...
Each one could have a different theme. One could be, like, a mid-century space age. You could have, like, a Logan's Run theme. You could have, like, the Vaporwave theme.
Yeah, it could. I mean, really, it would just be whatever the aesthetic preference is of the people that are going to make it and live there, you know, which it could be anything.
Or
really,
you could. It could be a Greco-Roman or a Greco-Roman Vaporwave.
Exactly. Like, it could be built, like, in the Greco-Roman style, but, of course, with, like, the, you know, technological amenities of today, you know, within that. I think that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in. So whenever people read, like, my blog or writing or anything, and they say, like, oh, you know, like, you're racist, like, how are you going to make the, you know, America's always been multicultural or anything, like, how are you going to change it with these hundreds of millions of people? Like, that, you know, that is, doesn't have anything to do with my political goals. Like, I'm not invested in the idea of, you know, quote-unquote America, at all. Like, it's just, you know, my ideas are to convey these types of stuff, to create some kind of new society, and I don't really care where it is.
Well, it's interesting because you're building a new society, but you're borrowing on aspects of Americana and even of sort of American capitalism. What's interesting about the mall is that the mall kind of came about as a product of like a culture where people had to draw, like, instead of originally, people lived in these small towns and they walked everywhere, and then the car came about and people drove to these malls. This is something that would be based kind of on the mall model, but it would be self-sufficient. People would not have to drive everywhere. In a sense, they would have their own community there. And a traditionalist are going to sort of hate this idea. And I don't really care about appeasing them. I don't really care what they think. But I think this idea would create a much stronger community if it was among like-minded people than like your typical American community. You're basically like your typical American suburban community.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, even though like the traditionalists would hate this for our aesthetic preferences and like, the kind of like culture we would have, but really like these kinds of ideas would be applicable if they wanted to create something similar that was more traditional. You know, it's still the same conceptually, like the same things would come into play. They would just have different preferences in terms of how things would look and like what laws there would be and societal norms. I think that you know, the main thing is that, for me, is that to create one of these places, you would also have to make it, you would have to find a way to sufficiently defend it from outsiders. So it would require some kind of military deterrent or whatever, which is some kind of advanced technology and like a little bit of manpower, like you could probably sufficiently deter people from this thing. I I've always said that I think Scientology represents a good example for something that could be made or learned that's kind of autonomous, because Scientology, they have their own communities that are their own schools and their own kind of like almost their own like military units, their own security and their own like punishments and whatnot. It's almost totally autonomous because they've managed to buy up land and just create these autonomous areas where nobody even really knows what goes on there. So I actually think that, like, even though I'm not a Scientologist, I think that they in some ways offer up a blueprint for how somebody could form an autonomous like civilization that could eventually branch off and be completely its own thing, if it's done far enough away from the country.
Rabbit, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.